This is Patrick Wannis, human behavior and relationship expert and therapist, PhD. One of the greatest challenges presented to me by parents when speaking about their children is the challenge and serious problem with drugs. What can you, as a parent, do about your children and drugs? How do you handle drugs? What do you do if you suspect your children might be taking drugs? How do you approach your children? What do you do if you find out your children are taking drugs? And how can you, if possible at all, protect and prevent your children from taking drugs? For the answer to these questions, I'm turning today to Aaron Huey, a friend and colleague who is with Fire Mountain Sober Living Home for Teens in Boulder, Colorado. Hello, Aaron.
Hey, Patrick.
This is going to be the greatest challenge for all parents. How do you protect your children from drugs? Now, before we get into that, could you please tell us a little bit more about your Fire Mountain Sober Living Home for Teens?
A sober living home is a place where people go and live before or after a rehab type situation. It can be used as a mini rehab. It can be used as a diagnostic type environment. And by that, I mean parents know something are going on. They know the kids are doing drugs. The kids are, you know, kicked out, failing out, quitting school, and are just caught up in the wrong crowd. This is a place where people go and live in a community of individuals who are dealing with the same type of issues. So the work very much gets centered around a community healing and learning how to reintegrate into whatever's next the work that you do here. Our facility is unique in the way is that we focus on integration, which means we don't just do the work. Because we live in Boulder and because, you know, we're not isolated as a medical facility or as a hospital, we utilize the community that we're surrounded by to reach out to these kids and to help these kids resource themselves in a community of people who don't use, who don't ditch, who don't find the alternatives to a contribution in their community. And by that I mean we really are looking for ways for these kids to become active, positive members of their community. Some of our kids who leave here do go on to wilderness facilities. Some of our kids are from wilderness facilities or rehabs. Some of our kids come to us having been thrown out of every school they've gone to, and the parents are at their wit's end. And so not only is there an opportunity for the kid to start doing work, but there's an opportunity for the parents to begin to do work reparenting.
Now, that's the key, right? It's something that we will get into in a moment to talk about the role of parents and how they affect their children, how they impact their children, or how they infect their children. And I want to just share this story quickly, and I have many questions about the Fire Mountain Sober Living Home for Teens. But I recall a few years ago a very good friend of mine having a big argument with her father because she was starting to get into drugs, and she turns around to her father and says, "But wait a minute, Daddy, you used to take drugs when you were a kid." And, of course, he grew up in the 60s, and he was very heavy into drugs, and he said, "Oh, it was different in my time." Now, that very argument may be true to a certain extent if we were to look at drugs in the context of the 60s, which was about social rebellion, rebelling against the establishment, experimentation, and there might be some of that today. There was also the aspect today of which is common to the 60s and to the 21st century, and that's peer group pressure. But we also have what we're seeing today, and I know we're going to talk about this in a moment, that a lot of kids aren't just turning to drugs as a way of getting a new high. They're turning to drugs as some form of emotional stability, as an emotional, mental, psychological crutch, as well as an escape to the world that they're not enjoying. And we'll come back to that in a moment, but I wanted to add that because you're right, that's a very big aspect of it, the role of the parents. What ages are you dealing with, Aaron?
Well, once again, this is where our facility is unique. We work with kids ages 14 to 17, are considering moving the age range down to 13, and we have had parents of teens as young as 12 contact us. There simply aren't the resources for kids between the ages of 12 and 17 to do this type of work that we're offering. Once they turn 18, there are a lot more options available to parents.
All right. Right at this moment, you're sounding very calm when I respond with shock to say, you are telling me that 12-year-old children are addicted to drugs?
I was one of them. I started using drugs at 12 years old and began my experimentation that led to use, which led to abuse, which led to dependency at that age, lasting all the way through college and beyond until I was 28. So my first experience with drugs, and I speak as a constantly recovering addict. I'm now 13 years sober. They start young, and they're getting younger every single year.
When you talk about a 12-year-old either using, abusing, or being dependent and addicted on drugs, what kind of drugs are we speaking about?
Well, unfortunately, this is where a lot of, at least back in the 80s and 90s, the concept of what kind of drugs you can get addicted to was always up for question. The stance we take is it's not the drugs. It's not pot. It's the person. Unfortunately, nowadays we are seeing kids as young as 12, they get into ecstasy. Ecstasy is so readily available and has the same old-fashioned arguments that marijuana used to have, that it really doesn't do any harm, there really is no side effects, and of course that's all crap. The problem with ecstasy is that pure MDMA, which is a chemical that our brain produces, the chemical version of MDMA copies that chemical in our brain and replaces it, so our brain stops producing it. That's a whole conversation in itself. But ecstasy, which is the more extracurricular version of MDMA, is always cut with meth, coke, and heroin, and the like. So ecstasy, which is a very popular drug right now, which kids younger and younger are taking, is in fact a very serious gateway drug because of what it's cut with, because what these kids are also ingesting rather than pure MDMA.
So what you're saying is they are taking ecstasy, which has been tainted with other drugs, that then leads them to potentially become dependent and addicted to other drugs?
And again, we come back to, is the person an addict? Is the person just using drugs and medicating themselves and needs a different path of self-support? Or do they have this gene, which now 10 hospitals are offering medical licenses specifically in the disease of addiction? Once again, this brings up all the old arguments about whether addiction is a disease or not. Not being a doctor, I don't have a clear answer, but I can tell you from doing the work that I do, I see two types of drug users. I see addicts, and I see people who use too many drugs.
Okay, so really we're talking about what is sometimes referred in the adult treatment centers as a dual diagnosis. That means dealing with the physical, chemical desire, craving, and addiction to the drug, and then dealing with the mental, emotional, psychological desire, craving, and addiction to the drug, correct?
We're dealing with, yes, it is correct. We are dealing with people who are born with a intolerance that leads to the addictive behaviors of drugs versus people who try them, like them, and overuse them just as a person would overuse Advil to mask pain.
Okay, so in your center, the Fire Mountain Sober Living Home for Teens, you're dealing right now from 14 to, I guess, 18, 19?
The 14 to 17. Once a person turns 18, legally you cannot have adults by age. Because certainly emotionally, an 18-year-old addict is not 18 years old emotionally, but when they are the age of 18, they cannot legally be residing with children, with minors.
All right. So you're dealing with underage children, and
yes,
you're working to get even younger, to help even younger children who have a problem with this. You're saying to me that the parents bring them in, or do the children and the parents bring themselves in?
We are the, that's a very interesting question. Number one, we're always talking to the parents first, but we have had kids as young as 14 contact us and say, I need help. Can I come stay at your facility? My mom is in full support of this. Now, of course, because of the age, we cannot do anything without the parents' consent. And, you know, the paperwork that's involved for the legalities around having someone else's child reside with us, even for a short period of time, are very intense. But this is a place where people come and stay willingly. We're not a lockdown facility. We're not a medical facility in that way. We're a home. We're a group home for teenagers who are struggling and their lives have become dysfunctional, and the family is in a state of crisis, everybody. So yes, sometimes the kids come first, and sometimes 90% of the time it's the parents who are contacting us first saying, this is out of control. I need help. Can you help me? We take it from there.
Okay. But if the parents, if you're saying that this is not a lockdown facility, then obviously you need the desire and the volition of the children themselves. They have to be there, correct?
It's absolutely correct. Our doors are not locked, and the teens who are here, they stay here of their own free will. Now, that being said, if one of them was to book in the middle of the night, we're going to do everything in our power, both legally and personally, to get that child back. It's our responsibility. We would call the police, we'd contact the parents, we'd locate the child. We would decide at that point with the therapists, our own staff, and the parents if the child needed a deeper level of intervention than we are providing, and act accordingly. But in our time of doing this, we've had one runner, and when he was found, he was brought back, he finished out his program. But the kids stay because because it's working. This type of environment for kids is working.
All right, there's the next big question. How is it working, and what do you do that makes it work?
For us, as I said, our focus is so deep on integration, which means the family stays involved. This is not a place you send your child. Like some wilderness programs, you send your child and 2 months later you're allowed to call them. We work with the parents on a weekly basis. And when the child is sober, and by that I mean their first stage, and I'll explain the stages in a second, the first stage when the kid is here is the sobriety stage. And that means they get sober. We get all the drugs out of their system so that we can start dealing with the issues that they've been medicating. If you keep taking aspirin and go to a doctor and he says, where does it hurt? How do you tell him if you're not feeling the pain? So the first stage is to get all the drugs out of the system so we can see where the pain, where the crisis, where the dysfunction actually exists. And we begin to treat that pain, that crisis, and that dysfunction. Of course, all along dealing with the drugs issues and addiction issues through the 12 steps, working with the family and helping them create a space and a container for this child when they return.
Okay. Now you talked about the pain, the crisis, the wound. Are you referring to a mental, emotional, psychological pain, crisis, and wound?
I am. With addicts, with people who are using too many drugs, we're talking about self-medicating. We're talking about whether they tried drugs, really liked it, got into it, or whether there was a crisis lifestyle before that. Either way, 100% of the time, we are looking at teens who are medicating pain. Whether it's woken up the addict dragon or not, so we deal with the pain. You get off the Advil, you get off the Tylenol, you work with the pain. Why does your leg hurt? It is no different with drugs.
Okay. So, for example, I have had a number of clients who were addicts, and they often began because they were treating a particular symptom, obviously. Some cases, that was a physical symptom. I had a back pain, I had a back accident, I started to take this painkiller, and then I became addicted. And when I begin to work with them, I uncover that the painkiller isn't and wasn't just killing a physical pain, it was killing or numbing an emotional pain.
And that numbing that we're talking about, that's the key there. It's the numbing. Where there's knots, they're tied up in knots. They're in pain. And when you use, when you drink, the knots go away. That's attractive to anyone, especially a teenager. If mom and dad are divorced and mom's sleeping alone and dad's moved to another state and, you know, and these kids experience what the parents are going through. It's a trickle down effect. And then they go to a party, they drink, and the knots go away, and they feel good. And who doesn't want to feel good? So next thing you know, they're trying to feel good as much as possible. In any other context, that makes sense. But the type of feeling good that you and I talk about, that takes work, and these kids don't know how to do that work.
So you mentioned a couple of examples there, or you mentioned at least one, and that is if parents have divorced, the mum sleeping alone, the child starting to experience some of the emotional pain that might be residue, or the child takes on the pain of the parent. And this is something that I remember saying to a friend of mine who is the owner of Milestone Malibu, when I said to him, you know, one of the things that I've realized from working with clients is that children believe that they're the center of the universe. What I mean by that is that a child takes on the responsibility and the blame for everything that happens in his or her life. So if mommy and daddy are getting along well, that means I'm doing good. If mom and dad are fighting, it must be my fault. If mom or dad walks out on the other person, they're walking out on me, must be my fault. If dad hits me, it must be because I'm bad. If dad's hitting mom and I'm not stopping him, that means there's something wrong with me. So children often feel that they're the center of the universe. In other words, they're controlling everything around them. So therefore, they blame themselves for what's going on, as well as taking on the emotional pain. Can you give me a couple of examples without obviously infringing upon client confidentiality, but an example of why a child is in your home, what is happening to him or her, so that everyone listening to this call can relate?
Number one, so that everybody can get a grip on this, we're talking about the signs and symptoms of the pain. And that's usually what the parents are mostly in a state of reaction to. That's usually what the schools are having to deal with. The schools don't have the time or the resource, and God bless the hearts of every teacher and educator out there. They don't have the time or the resources to really get into a kid's psyche to figure out why their homework is the way that is, and how many questions could be answered if we could. Excuse me for soapboxing here for a second, but if we could create in junior high school an avenue of emotional health, just like we have physical health or mental health within our schools, if we created emotional health, that would answer a lot of our questions. But we're dealing with kids, with these teens, we're dealing with their symptoms of their issues. And these symptoms are the signposts that for parents to start looking out for to really get a clue on how deep their kids are into the game. But when we talk about what kind of kids come to Fire Mountain Sober Living Home, we have a lot of kids with adoption trauma, that primal wound of abandonment. We have a lot of kids with abandonment trauma. We do have kids who are dual diagnosis, which means they're bipolar, or they're borderline personality disorder, or they're mild schizophrenia, and the medication's not working. And so they begin to self-medicate because, frankly, some of those medications do work for them for a short period of time. But any time a kid starts to use drugs or alcohol to medicate their pain, it creates its own wreckage. And it's this wreckage that the parents start living with, and these outbursts of anger, and these, we have angry kids. We have upset kids. We have kids who've been thrown out of school and have failed. We have kids in broken families and intact families. We have families here who are perfectly put together still, but the kid is dealing with something, whether it's the addiction or whether it's bullying from the past, or we have kids who are still trying to cope and function with a system, and by that I mean the personal, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual system that frankly is dysfunctional. If there is dysfunction, we add therapy and we add medication to help them function. If these kids are not getting adequate therapy or adequate medication, be it Western or Eastern medicine, they will self-medicate. It's because from all outward appearances, it works. But like I said, you start smoking pot and it works. So you start smoking pot every day because who doesn't want to be happy and mellow every day? And next thing you know, your homework's not getting done and you start failing. And then your parents are yelling at you because you're failing school. And that adds to the pain. And because they're teenagers, the emotional leverage that a parent has, do as I say or else, or, you know, we really want you to do this. We're so proud of you and we love you. Whether it's positive or negative emotional leverage, as parents, we lose that emotional leverage as our kids begin to pull away from us, which is natural adolescent development. And as they pull away, everything we say, it lands less and less. And so the kids aren't listening to their parents. This is a time when we're not supposed to. This is a time where kids are supposed to discover who they are. So if who they are has become identified with drugs, or drinking, or using ecstasy and going to raves, if their identity becomes wrapped up in a subculture, a fringe group, the druggies, the stoners, the ravers, then all of a sudden their life begins to mimic that darkness. And they see it. These kids are not blind. They know they're failing school. They know when they come home they're going to get yelled at. They know they're going to get grounded and get their phones taken and not be allowed on Facebook. And so they react. How do they react? They sneak out. They find friends who have snuck out. They use drugs together. They don't get up the next morning to go to school. Now they've missed school another day. The homework situation's gotten worse. So you know what they do to make those guilt and anguish and frustration go away? They use. And when they use, they're not able to catch up with. And this dysfunctional cycle begins. Those are right. The kids we get. We get kids who are caught in the whirlpool of self-destruction.
Okay, now you mentioned a couple of things that I'd like to address. The first one related to attaching drugs to their identity and their image. And I've encountered this with adult clients, one of whom was sexually abused as a child, became a stripper, obviously got into drugs and alcohol because there was any way she could still strip and be able to handle what she was doing. And then she said to me that the greatest challenge for her getting off that alcohol was her fear of who would she be without the alcohol? What kind of person would she be? What would her identity be? So obviously that same principle applies to the children you're working with. But you also talked about children coming to you with anger and children coming to you with abandonment issues. So my question is, do you believe that these children have an organic disorder, an organic problem, meaning that there's something wrong with their brain, or is it 99% the result of them trying to fit in with the world around them and trying to handle all the challenges and pressures that are thrown at them?
I do not have the type of training to be able to say with any confidence, and I do not say to parents, your child's an addict. No, your child's just using too many drugs. That's not my place. But I will say this. Every child that we see, whether they're dealing with abandonment issues, whether they're dealing with sexual abuse, whether they're dealing with anger issues, or whether they're an addict, every single one of them has the same missing piece, and that's self-concept. And what you said about the stripper, that's exactly it. Who am I without this? Well, that question begins in adolescence. And when you don't have an intact family, or if you have been adopted and so you have these missing roots, or if you are so angry because such and so has happened in your life, you don't know who you are. And we know instinctively that we do not survive without a culture. If we are left alone to fend for ourselves, and while everybody else is living in communities and caves, we know instinctively we will die. So now, the ego, the drive of survival will put us into a group. So frankly, since the like is attracted to the like, I don't know where we came up with opposites attract, but since the like is attracted to the like, we're going to find people who resonate, vibrate, and express and experience the same types of things we do. It's how we feel we belong. And so if our experience is dysfunction, we will identify with a group of people who are caught up in dysfunction. And I hear this from every single parent, the kids they're hanging out with. It's this group they're hanging out with. And Patrick, you and I have both heard the phrase uttered, if you want to know who you are, take a good look at your friends. And this is what we're talking about.
I'd like to answer the 2 points or respond to the 2 points you raised. When you talked about who came up with the expression of opposites attract, when I'm talking about personality types, I say that opposites in personality types work in terms of temperament, that an outgoing person is usually balanced by a quieter person. A person that loves to get attention needs someone that's going to give them attention. So in that sense, opposite temperaments can be quite balancing. However, like does attract like in terms of values. We're attracted to people that have the same values, standards, principles, and beliefs as us. The next point is when you talked about we need culture, we need to connect, otherwise we're going to die, that fits in with what I teach as 6 key, critical, crucial human emotional needs. The first is love and connection. So children are going to look for, where can I feel connected to a wider community? Where can I feel this sense of love, which is also about a sense of approval and acceptance? The second is about challenge. You know, I want to be challenged. The third is actually about security. So if I'm in this group, I'm also getting a sense of security, approval, and acceptance. The next is a level of significance. If I'm in this group and the people like me and the people need me, I'm feeling significant. The final two are a chance for me to grow and evolve and having a meaning and purpose. Now, of course, very few of us ever really get all of those 6 needs met, but the very basic ones are the ones that are driving these children to partner up with other people who have the same values, beliefs, and challenges and pain and issues as they do. And that's the need to connect to a wider community, to have a sense of belonging, to identify with other people who identify with the same things. So that makes a lot of sense. Now, you also talked there about parents bringing them in and parents responding to you. So I guess the next question is, how do you deal with the parents?
Well, number one, sitting a parent down and pointing a finger at them and going down a checklist of everything they've done wrong does not work. That's not it. No one handed us a manual when we became parents. And frankly, if there is a manual out there, there are missing pages around how to empower your child to make powerful decisions that will help them avoid these groups of people, especially if your child is at a young age dealing with any type of emotional crisis, abandonment, sexual abuse, adoption, these types of issues. So,
well, please, Aaron, give us some of these answers, though. You know, what can parents do to empower their children to say no? What advice can you give to parents?
Number one, as early as you can, only offer choices that you can live with. Let me give you an example. I see so often, especially in Boulder, where there's a belief that, you know, the child should be free to make their own choices. That really leads down a dark path later in life. No child exists well without a container. So when your child is young and you're saying, okay, it's time to go, put on your shoes, I don't want to wear shoes, now we have the power struggle. And in that moment of power struggle, That's a key moment, because this power struggle is going to mimic its way all through life. So if you begin to battle, you have to wear shoes. Everybody wears shoes. Wearing shoes is the right thing to do. You're feeding the power struggle. Whereas to say, well, that's not an option, but green shoes or your red shoes, which one would you like? See, I'm the parent. I'm good with both choices. We start young. If we cannot start young, we still do it when they're older. They will rebel. They will fight. They will become aggressive. When kids do that in their teen years, children have learned that because the parents' emotional leverage has diminished, kids have learned that because they're pulling away from their family or because they're always fighting with their family, they care less what their parents think than what their friends think. This is the moment that we close in on the kid, not back off. This is the moment where we increase the community, not isolate.
Trauma, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by that?
Let me give you an example. If your child, your teenager, if you catch him smoking pot, the first reaction is the surprise, the frustration, the anger, the feelings of betrayal. Have those. Those are natural reactions to having when you discover your kid is doing something illicit. Have those. Then do consequence. Not in the same day either. Talk to a therapist. Talk to friends. Make some phone calls. Tell your friends. Call the kid's football coach. Call the teachers that the kid respects and says, what do I do? I've discovered pot in little Johnny's room. What do I do about this? What would you do? Get a community. Healing takes place in a community. And so often we're so frustrated and embarrassed by what's going on that we isolate. And our kids are already isolated and self-medicating and reaching out to their subcultures to get their community that is helping cause this issue. Parents need to get community back. You want to be able to meet your kid where they are. So you need a community to do that. Kids throw zingers at us. These teens are not stupid. They're smart. They pay attention to what's going on in the news. They talk about it at school. They talk about it when they're together. They talk about it when they're high. And so when your kid comes and throws one of these zingers at you, take a minute. Don't immediately react. Don't punish based on how you feel. Your feelings don't have the emotional leverage they used to. What has leverage is when a whole group of people show up, a whole group of people who love this kid and want to support this kid and want to see this kid succeed.
All right.
When they all show up to the table.
Let me ask you a couple of questions, Phil, because you've covered so much powerful material here. I want to make sure that I'm clear on what you're saying and that everyone listening is also clear. So step number one, and this is something I have discussed before with, and I think you might also be friends with Dr. Vicky Panachone, from the Better Parenting Institute. She and I have talked about how children need boundaries. They need parameters. They need what you call the container. I call it foundation. I call it structure, which gives them a sense of security, a sense of safety, a sense of stability. And that is, there are certain rules, there are certain regulations. You have freedom within those rules and regulations. So as you put it, okay, Johnny, you have to wear shoes, but would you like to wear the red shoes or the green shoes? So
now, let me say something real quick here, because this is very important, and this is where we see a lot of parents drop the ball, and I'm guilty of that. And for the people listening, I want them to know, not only am I a father, I'm a stepfather, and I have two teenagers, so I've been through the process. I'm not speaking about which I don't know and haven't failed at and succeeded at and screwed up and fixed. And when you set the boundary, your kid's natural design is to test that wall to see if it's made of paper or concrete.
Yeah,
if you are putting a container, a foundation in place that is not real, if you're making threats, you do this and I'll such and so, but he knows and you know that you're really not going to do that, it's meaningless. You must only threaten or deliver consequences on things that you will follow through on. Because when you do, it's a real container. The one time you let it go, they know, and they will get you there every single time. It's their design. This is not attitudinal. This is developmental.
Now, the interesting aspect of that from a human behavior perspective is that, yes, people will always test those rules or test what you're saying. And when you stand firm, you actually empower the child to feel safer and stronger in his or her environment, knowing that you are dependable, you are consistent, that you will not be easily shaken. And if you act in a way that is consistent, fair, and reasonable, you're actually helping the child. Of course, if you take it to an abusive extreme, then that's a different point. But when you do that, and you know this as well from the other courses you've taught, Aaron, that women do this to you in a relationship. They're going to test you. They're going to see how strong are you. Are you going to live up to your word? They're going to test you to try and push you away and see, will you still stand there when I push you away? Will you still love me in spite of who I am and in spite of what I do? And children do that as well.
And the greatest gift of love you can offer a child is loving, realistic boundaries.
Loving, realistic boundaries. Can you explain that one more time?
Once again, if you're saying to your child, I told you to turn the TV off an hour ago. If you don't turn it off right now, you're grounded for 3 weeks. It's not realistic. That's not a realistic consequence. That's an emotional reaction. And if your whole parenting style is based on emotional reaction, you will lose face. You will lose ground. You will lose your child. But if you're saying...
What would be a realistic consequence of saying to your child, turn off this TV I told you an hour ago, and if you don't do it within the next 5 minutes, I will do what?
Okay, so here would be how I would respond to that. And I'm talking, you've got a teenager who's completely blowing you off. This is the big test. This is a big moment. My first response is, I asked you to turn off the TV an hour ago. What's going on? Answer, answer, answer. Wow, I'm feeling really frustrated about this because I'm feeling disrespected and I'm just very frustrated right now. And I love you too much to argue with you. So we're going to turn off the TV now. And the parent goes and turns off the TV. And I'm going to go ahead and take this remote. And we're not going to do TV until I know that there's a mutual respect around this in the house. I love the TV. I know you love the TV. But there are other things to do, and we need to do them now. When they're done, we can talk about having the TV back again. Now, this is where the teen's going to amp up. This is where I hate you, you're crazy, you're stupid. That's when the parent goes, and I'm going to steal from Love and Logic here, that's where the parent goes brain dead. You do not buy in to adolescent arguments. These are children we're talking about. And this is the most, this part gets me so much when I see parents and teenagers arguing at a teenage level, or parents trying to get teenagers to understand adult concepts. That doesn't work. If a parent is arguing at a teenage level, then we're going to get an adolescent emotional experience. If the parent keeps trying to get the kid, you need to understand, you should respect, you need to do this, you have to get this, do you really understand what the adolescent brain is capable of understanding? Are we talking about attitude? Or are we talking about capability here? Are we talking about willingness? Are we talking about developmental realism?
Well, the human brain doesn't fully develop until the early 20s and a little bit older for boys than girls. So
exactly.
What is the response that you would suggest for that parent when the teen is amping up and saying, I hate you and you're an idiot and blah, blah, blah?
Well, number one, when the teen is saying something to try to push the buttons, you have to disengage the buttons. So if you're getting the, you're crazy, you make all these stupid rules, your response is, I know. But we say it with empathy, not with attitude, with empathy. We have to feel sorry that they're not able to understand what we're doing. When they have kids of their own, they'll understand. Hopefully that's a long time from now. So, you know, you're being stupid, you're being retarded. I know. Well, I don't understand this. I know, this must be frustrating for you. I hate you. Nice try. When they say the things that we know aren't true, we don't bite. We say, nice try. And we begin our conversation in a loving way. I feel frustrated. I feel angry. We have empathy for the kid because this is obviously something they don't understand, and they're not going to in this moment anyway. And we end it with love. I hate you. Nice try. I love you too much to argue. I'm not going to do this now. We'll talk about this in a couple days. If it keeps going beyond that, we walk out. We say, this is too much for me. I don't know what to do about this now. This started with a very simple thing around the TV, and now we're into I hate you and all this type of stuff. I don't know what to do. So I'm not going to do anything right now. Try not to worry about it. We'll talk again later.
Now, and that give argument, go on.
And give yourself space to deal with your own emotions in an adult way, and then come back to the kid and meet them where they are in a loving, empathic, empathizing way so that they feel heard and validated, and you can express control of the situation rather than losing your crap all over the place and you having a screaming match with your teenager. You sound like a teenager, the teen sounds like a teenager, or you just get frustrated because you want them to understand what it's like to be a parent, and when you make rules and you got to follow rules and you got to do this and society needs this and you can't just do this wherever you want. It's not something the adolescent brain gets. So why bother? Set
now,
the boundary.
What you also talked about there in that emotional argument can also be the result of other things going on in the teen's life or the adolescent's life that need addressing, and maybe the parent isn't a place to address or not address that particular problem, which leads me back to another thing you talked about when you referred to creating a community of intervention. So if there's a problem with the child, rather than trying to deal with it on your own, particularly if you're a parent, a single parent, or a parent trying to raise a child on your own for whatever reason, that's when you need to bring in other people. Now, if you're a woman and you're raising a son and he's now 14 years of age, you are not, I don't care how talented you are, how smart you are, what kind of divine goddess you think you are, that boy needs some masculine energy, another man to come in and connect with him on another level. And I guess what I'm saying to you here is that I'm supporting and agreeing with what you're talking about, community, but how do you do that? Is it calling other teachers in? Is it calling your aunt, your uncle? Who do you turn to?
Well, number one, I want to say not only is your example of the single mother with a 14-year-old son dead on, I was a single father with a daughter, and it's no different. The gift of femininity cannot be passed on from the father to daughter. And the gift of masculinity cannot be passed on from mother to son. And if we recognize this and we get over ourselves so that we can really have support and help as parents, as single parents, as married parents, whether we're single or married, this rule goes into play. Get support. Go to an Al-Anon meeting and just ask some questions. Contact a therapist and ask for a session. Contact a parenting coach. Go to a Love and Logic class and listen to the stories that the other parents are telling about their teens. Call your best friend and ask if she knows anybody who can help. Find the person at work who you know has teenagers and say, can I talk to you for a minute? Can I take you out for coffee? Can we hang out at lunch? I got something going on at home. But this really does take parents getting over themselves. When I talk to parents on our first phone call, we do a free consultation phone call. If parents call us, we'll do a free phone call where we'll help be that first call where they can assess the situation and help them find support in their community. But when we get off the phone with this mom or this dad, we give them three rules. Number one, take care of yourself. That's it. Take care of yourself. That means you have to go to yoga. You have to do your breathing exercise. You have to go swimming. You have to take a walk. You have to start taking care of your body and your heart and your mind, because there is nothing you can do for your child if you're not taking care of yourself. Number two, you take care of your relationships. If you're married, if you have a boyfriend or a girlfriend, if you have a lover, You take care of that. You recognize that your personal life affects your relationships, and you start putting some energy into that immediately. And you two sit down and you cry together and you kiss and you hold and you shout and you get this stuff out and you take care of your relationship. Number three, now you can take care of the kid. When you have the foundations of care in place, and this is something that Patch Adams taught me many, many years ago, many, many moons ago, the whole family is affected. If your grandma doesn't have Alzheimer's, your family has it. And you have to take care of yourselves too. That's the only way you'll be able to take care of grandma. And that's the same with the teenage son or daughter.
Can you repeat those as 3 points once again?
Number one, take care of yourself first. Now, this has a double meaning, so I want to expand on this just a tiny bit. This means in the middle of that fight, if that's what taking care of yourself looks like, is screaming at your teenager because you're so angry and frustrated and overworked and underpaid and underappreciated and feeling unloved in that moment, if screaming at your teenager looks like you taking care of yourself, by all means do it. But if it's not, stop and do what taking care of yourself looks like. Ask yourself in that situation, when you find the pot in your kid's room, you say, what does taking care of myself look like? I got a phone call today from a mother who's asking for help. She's pregnant, she's 8 months pregnant, has a 14-year-old son who's losing it. He's angry, he's been physically violent, he's destroyed things in the house. That's my response to her. When he goes into that space, what does taking care of yourself look like? She goes, I feel like I need to call the cops. Should I do that? Should I call the cops on my son? How can I do that? And my answer is, if you do it, is that taking care of yourself? And she says, yes, I have to protect myself. I said, then as hard as that may be, do it. Number two, take care of your relationships. If you're involved in a relationship, and even if you're not with a lover, with a friend, take care of that relationship because it's affecting your friendships. And these people love you and are with you for a reason. So reach out right there. Connect. Reconnect. Find that essence contact. Have that direct experience of love because that's the best support. Number three, when those first two are done, then and only then will you be able to take care of the kid in crisis. If we try to circumvent and jump to the third and make the third one first, it won't work. Because if you do something for your kid that does not look like you taking, and I say this to parents, should I send them to the sober home? I say, if you do, is that you taking care of yourself? Well, it's taking care of my kid. I don't want my kid to leave the house. Then I say, this will never work.
Why would it never work? Explain that.
Because the parent isn't comfortable with what they're doing. The parent is not in harmony with their own decisions. There are hard decisions to make, but if you really see it as a way of taking care of yourself, look, every single kid in this house that I have has been running their homes. These are 13 to 17-year-olds who've been running entire households. That's how much power their actions have placed. Every time the phone rings, the parent stresses out. Oh, my God, what's she done now? The younger brother, the younger sister is starting to feel neglected because all the attention, which is so constantly negative, is focused on the sibling who's in crisis. And guess what? That starts another crisis. These kids run their house. None of them are qualified to. And it's a hard question, but it's a way that I can really hear in a parent's voice whether or not they get a good grip on what's going, because I ask them in the initial intake, is this kid running the home? Oh, no, you know, it's like he's been kicked out of school, he doesn't have a job, he sits on the couch all day, I can't move him, I can't do this, I can't sleep, I can't work. They're running the house. 9 times out of 10, I hear a parent go, yeah, they're in charge here. You got to take your house back, and you won't be able to do it until you start taking care of yourself and take care of your marriage.
All right, so the parent, to take care of it, obviously, one of the things that I teach is in any relationship, begin by changing yourself. Work on yourself.
Yeah.
So even when I have someone who comes to me and says, I have a problem with my wife, I have a problem with my husband, I say, okay, let's start working with you first, and then we'll worry about your husband or wife, because often you'll see things will change. And I actually have a situation like that where a client came to me, was paying for the therapy for his fiance, who definitely wanted the therapy but couldn't afford it. And as she got better, he said, Patrick, you're right, I'm now ready, I have to work on myself because I see her getting better and I'm still having the same problems I had before, because he recognizes now that her stuff is her stuff is his stuff. So my response to you is, obviously what you're saying makes complete sense. As a parent, begin by being healthy yourself. But how does a parent become healthy when his or her teenager, 14, 15, 16, is so out of control that they're running the house in the sense of consuming all of the energy and the attention and creating all the problems? How does that parent get healthy?
Well, again, we come back to very simply, start going to the gym again, take walks, have some space between this experience that has you in such deep reaction and the reality of what you need to do next. It's so hard when we get the calls from the parents, and the parents are so upset that we can barely understand them. I know they're upset. I know they're sad. But I can't help to wonder, is this phone call and in this massive emotional reaction this person is having, I can't tell whether they're done or not. And that's another one of the questions we have.
What do you mean whether they're done or not?
Well, when a parent calls and says, my kid's running the house, I can't take this anymore. You know, they're terrible to their siblings. They're completely disrespectful. They snuck out last night. They ran away 2 weeks ago. They're failing out of school. And I say very simply, are you done? And what I'm looking for is a parent go, yeah, I'm done. I'm done. What do I do? Versus the, well, you know, when you say, are you done? You know, am I going to do this? And I don't know and stuff. That means they're not done. The child will only behave in a way that's tolerated. And when your tolerance has ended, that's when real change can take place. Patrick, you and I have seen that it's that moment of crisis where the person says, enough. Anthony Robbins talked about that, about how he finally started losing weight when he used to be so big. He stood up in the restaurant and he said, enough. And it was over. From that moment on, he began to take his life back. And when I get a phone call from a parent who has said, enough, I don't know what to do next.
Are you referring to what I call, and of course I didn't create it, it's a Freudian principle, the pain and pleasure principle, which by extension means when the pain becomes too much, we then say it's time to take action, it's time to make a change.
Yes, it's the cost and payoff argument. It's now that the cost of what's going on is so out of proportion to the payoff that it cannot continue.
All right, there's a couple more things I'd like to include, and we could obviously speak all day and all night on this. Give me a brief summation of what else you do to help transform this child within the community that you create at the Fire Mountain Sober Living Home for Teens.
Number one, we are a community. And so these kids live with other kids. And of course, not only our adult supervision staff, but with our therapists and with the counselors and the coaches that we've brought in from the community that know how to reach these kids. Number two, we keep these kids out in their community. We do not isolate them from the community. These kids, they go to the gym, they go to, they do service work, and the people at the gym know who these kids are. They know where they're coming from. When we walk in the door, they know because we've been very clear, and their support, their willingness to bring our home in to their business, their place of business or their place of service or whatever place we walk into, when these kids feel welcome there, despite what they've done, despite what they think of themselves, despite the wreckage they've been living in, they know that there's adults out there who will hold hands and ring up and welcome them in. Number three, we integrate this work. Every day we teach them life skills. See, Patrick, the hardest part is this isn't about do I say yes to drugs or do I say no to drugs? Because if the child begins to say no to drugs, when the child says no to drugs, there's a hole. Drugs fulfilled a need. And if we suddenly remove the drugs, there's a hole there. We have to fill it with empowered choices. So we teach life skills. And we, in addition to the therapy, and there's 3 to 6 therapy sessions a week that the kid has, but in addition to that, every day they're learning life skills. Today we started, they're designing their first apartments, and we're writing down all the furniture they have and everything they have at the house, and then we're going to put a price on all that so that they can see realistically what it means to live on your own. And then they're going to have, tomorrow our exercise in life skills is they're going to create a week's menu, what they eat when they're there. And then we're going to take them to the grocery store and we give them these grocery lists and they do a treasure hunt. And they put the price down of everything they want to eat in that week. And they come back with their jaws in their laps. I had no idea groceries cost this much. Now all of a sudden they understand why they have to have a job. Now they're starting to understand why school does matter. Now they're beginning to understand that there's a reality beyond the one that they think exists, and it's very real. And this is not something they always teach in high schools. The last piece is we work with the entire family unit. The families come here. In the kids' third stage, they're allowed to go out and hang out with their family. In the later half of the third stage, they're allowed back on Facebook. And they're allowed to reconnect with people in their community who are supportive of them. Ask that question. That's a powerful question.
How do you protect them from the people that they should not be hanging out with?
We vacate the space that they should employ. And that is the hardest thing to do as a parent. But it is the single most powerful thing I have ever found as a parent to do for my own children and for these children here, to let them understand the repercussions of life.
I need to understand that clearly myself. How do you protect them from hanging out with bad influences? You talked about vacating a space.
Yeah.
Can you
after
explain
you've
that?
Taught them, after you've taught them your values, and look, at 14, 15, 16, 17 years old, your kids know your values.
Right.
It's time for them to develop their own. And as they begin to do that, you begin to start to step back. Remember when I said when it's in crisis, you move forward. As you do the work, as you see the kids integrating the work, you begin to step back because they have to live in this world. And this world is Facebook. This world is texting. This world is a prolific acceptance of the drug culture.
Okay,
they have to live here. If you tell the kid he's allergic to ice cream and then send him to Baskin Robbins and say, don't eat it, relapse is inevitable. And the facts are there to prove it. The percentage of relapse out there is there to prove it for kids this age. So as they begin to demonstrate not only to us, but to the therapists, the other teachers here, the man who supervises our staff, and their parents, that they are using the work, then we all begin to slowly take a step back and we say, okay, go back on Facebook. Which one of those people are you going to delete? Well, I'm not going to delete this one. And our response is, that's an interesting choice. We'll see how it works out for you. And you just ask the questions and you vacate the space of giving them the answer. You've been giving them the answer for 14 years. They don't want it anymore. They're trying to figure out who they are.
Okay, so when you use the expression to vacate the space, what you're also saying, in with my words, is that you're creating a space of trust for them now to make choices on their own, and reminding them of the potential consequences of their choices.
Not reminding them. What we don't want to do is lecture. What we want to do is advocate. Look, let me say it this way. Let me tell you about a situation that took place in our house. We took the kids to the gym. And this gym we belong to, they know who we are. They know what we do. And in fact, the manager of the gym, the woman has a master's degree in working with at-risk youth, so she gets it. Two of our boys stole a wallet and a phone out of another person's locker. It was discovered. And when we walked into the situation, when we sat down with them, we said, this was an interesting choice. I'm wondering how or why you think that this was the thing that was going to get you home sooner, or how or why you think this was the choice that was going to lead you down the path that we know you want to go. You've told us you want to go down this path of progression and contribution. How does this match? And their answer is simple. It doesn't. So we just ask the question, what does? What do we do in this moment? And instead of being mad at them for doing this, and instead of expressing our frustration and punishing them, you guys, you're on lockdown. You're not allowed to leave. You can't go to the gym. We said, we have a lot of work to do now. And we really expect you guys to repay us for the amount of time and energy that we have to spend on this situation. But you see, the tone in my voice is not expressing my anger. I can tell them that I'm frustrated. I can tell them that I'm angry, but that belongs to me.
Okay.
Instead of trying to let me get to the vacating the space, because here's the example. I didn't tell them how they should feel about this. I didn't tell them what we were going to do next. And in fact, I even told them, try not to worry about it. Now, that's an NLP technique, try not to worry about it.
Yeah,
and I called the manager, and I called the police department, and I told them what was up. I called our county courts and told them what was going on. And I said, you know what? The gym might press charges. I don't know the answer to that. We won't have an answer for a couple of days. Try not to worry about it. Do you know what those kids did for 2 weeks?
they worried about it because you told them, worry about it.
That's not only that, but I didn't worry about it. I vacated the space of worry. I didn't tell them how to feel. I told them how I feel, and I backed out, and then I asked them how they felt. And they felt stupid. They felt stressed. They didn't sleep well. They didn't die, but they did handle it. They handled it. I didn't. I did my part. I did due diligence. I wanted to protect these kids and allow them to feel the natural consequence of their actions. But I kept backing out, saying, what are you going to do next?
Now, because you and I have such a close relationship, then I can challenge you and say to you, okay, did you also speak to them or present them with the question or pose the question to them as to what was their deeper motivation? Was this an act to get attention? Was this an act of self-sabotage? Was this an act to get back at someone? Was it an act to hurt themselves? Was it an act to test you? Do you go that deep with them on an incident such as this when they steal a phone and a wallet?
We do with the other therapists and the other adults in the house. We all sit together and we say, what do you think's going on? And it's not one pair of eyes who are very frustrated and angry trying to figure this out. It's a whole group of people who get to know these kids. And of course we did ask them, what were you thinking? And we got the answer we expected. We weren't.
And sometimes, do you believe, Aaron, that science, it is as simple as because they're a teenager and their brain hasn't fully developed and their frontal lobe hasn't fully developed, that they weren't thinking of the consequences? Or is it possible that they were really trying to either test you or push you away or hurt themselves? Is that a possibility?
Of course. The question always becomes with every actions with these teenagers, so that we and the parents and the staff and parents who are listening, so that you can get a bead on what's really going on, you have to ask yourself with every action, is this capability or willingness? Is this all they're capable of, or is this all they're willing to do? Is this how they're capable of acting and that's it, or is this all they're willing to do? And when you find the answer to that question, you get to that deeper layer of truth and you meet the kid there. And frankly, with our two kids that did this, there was one of each. There was one kid who's suffered a lot of brain trauma in his life, a lot of abuse. This is it. This is as good as it gets for this kid right now. And we know that this is not a bad attitude type thing with this kid. The other kid was just being stupid, and he was trying to show off, and he was trying to get people to surround him again and show up for him and close the container because, and this is what he told us, I'm scared to go home. And so he self-sabotaged. But the other kid, this wasn't sabotage. The other kid, he didn't think. He couldn't. This, and when we saw this action, we looked at this with this kid with the brain injuries and stuff, and we said, we have to get a different treatment plan for him. Because just going after the emotional piece or the intellectual piece is not enough. His structure is off. We have to rebuild this house from the basement. With the other kid who was just saying, I don't want to go home, we said, okay, what do you need? The other, the boy with the brain injury.
He was afraid, and he was trying to sabotage his success. He was trying to prevent himself from leaving that space and entering the space that requires greater responsibility and personal accountability, meaning the real world.
Yes, and he knew it, and his age denotes, and what has to happen next in his life was proof positive of what he was saying, and it was a desperate cry for help. But how could we ever have reached either of them if we just lashed out with our anger and grounded them and took away their phones and not let them get on Facebook? That's why that stuff doesn't work.
So you created the space where they had the opportunity to delve deeper into their own motivations, to realize that, particularly with the latter child, it's not just a random act. He has a motivation, and sometimes he's not consciously aware of that motivation, and he does it subconsciously. And I'll share this example because it's personal and it's so freaky. It took me at age 17, or maybe even 18, to recognize that every year for about 4 years or 5 years at that time, I was having a major serious accident in my life. And I was smart enough to say to myself, because I had no one else around me to question me. I didn't have an Aaron Huey or a Patrick Wallace to say, you know, okay, why did you do this? What was your choice? Or do you recognize, Patrick, that every year you're having a serious accident and you're ending up in hospital? And I was smart enough at the time to say, Patrick, how is it that every year you're having a serious accident? I noticed there was a pattern. And then I woke up to realize that I was, and I mean, I'm serious. I was 17, and I maybe this is why I'm doing what I'm doing now, because I had the perception and the insight to say, I must be creating this. Now, I hadn't read anything about the law of attraction or anything about New Age or how we create our own reality or the power of the subconscious mind. I'd read nothing. But I was smart enough in that moment to look at myself and say, this is not possible that every year a sheer accident happens where I'm knocked out unconscious, where I have a bike accident, I have to have an emergency plastic surgery operation, where I'm transported to hospital, where I hit a parked car and there's no other cars on the street, there's no traffic. How am I doing this? And I woke up at the time, Aaron, to realize I was doing that to get my parents' attention, because it was the only way that I could get my parents' attention where they wouldn't get angry at me, they wouldn't blame me, they'd say, oh, it was an accident, he was a victim. So I was playing the victim role, because if I actually got physically sick, there was a different response and reaction from my parents. Now it was, you're not allowed to be sick. What are you doing being sick? There was no empathy, compassion, or nurturing. The only fragments of empathy, compassion, and nurturing occurred when I had a major accident. But
so
somehow, go on.
So what happens with these kids? And your example is perfect. Because we created space there, instead of filling that space with our frustration and our anger and our punishment, because we just asked questions and we backed out of the space, the teens stepped forward and they answered the question for us. And we got a different one from each. Oh, it started with, we started with the question, what were you guys thinking? I don't know. I wasn't thinking. I just wanted it and I got it. You say, how does that match? And we just kept backing out with a question. And they kept stepping forward with an answer. Instead of us, that's wrong, and you can't steal things from people, and people go to jail for that, and blah, blah, blah. Underneath all their actions are virtues and values. And if you keep asking questions, they will reveal it. And with one of the kids, he revealed that there really wasn't conscious thought. And we saw very clearly his body was not capable of it. And so that changed our treatment plan, while the other kid came up and said, I'm scared to go home. I'm going to fail. I'm going to screw up. I'm going to relapse. I can't go yet. Keep me here.
And in 99% of the cases, with the exception of the first child that you said has actually had brain damage or has been affected, in 99% of cases, there's an emotional benefit to a subconsciously driven action. And
absolutely.
I gave you my example, or you gave me that boy's example. He was trying to keep himself safe. He wanted to feel comfortable. He was afraid of what he would experience if he went out in the outer world. He said, I want to stay here. I don't want to leave. So he was keeping himself safe. For me, when I was a teenager, the emotional benefit was getting some attention, a little bit of empathy, a little bit of compassion, and something else I didn't mention, where for a short period of time, maybe only a week, maybe 2 weeks, I was no longer responsible for my parents. It was the only time that my parents would act as parents to me, and I wouldn't be the parent to them. Now, I didn't have the complete understanding at a conscious awareness or at a conscious level, but I knew at that time, I recognized, I'm doing this for a reason. What the hell is the reason that I'm doing it? So I can only applaud, honor, acknowledge, praise, and thank the great work that you're doing, and try to share all the insights that you've shared with me with other people. I know I began the call by saying that we would answer the questions of, you know, how do you approach your children about drugs? And I think we've covered some of that. Maybe we haven't covered everything that I intended to set out to cover, which is okay, because I think what you've shared is even more powerful and maybe much more profound than, you know, can you go through your children's room and look for stuff? And I don't know if you have the answer to some of those questions on your website, because if you do, I'd love to direct people to that.
The resources for parents to search their kids' room for drugs, which is an important piece that we ask every parent to do, are pathetic. When you Google how to search your kid's room for drugs, you get two pages that actively speak to the parent about how to search their kid's room. But if you Google how to hide drugs from your parents, you get over 20,000 pages showing up.
That Are speak you to serious?
The, I am absolutely serious.
20,000 pages?
That speak to the teen on how to hide from their parents. So if you want to know how to search your kids' rooms for drugs, type in how to hide drugs from your parents and read those, because it's public information. It's out there. The as far as going through those steps, maybe we have to do a second call, Patrick.
Yeah, we do. But I'm just astounded. I actually went quiet and speechless, because this shows you how resourceful teens can be. And if they redirect that energy into goal setting for their life, they can achieve extraordinary things.
And I will tell you that how well they hide it is a good sign of how deep they're in.
Oh, that's interesting. How well they hide it is a sign of how deep they're in, which means how deep they're into the drugs, how emotionally challenged they are.
Or how well resourced they are in self-medicating.
Okay. Well, Aaron, so your website is?
Fire Mountain Programs. And you can email me at Aaron at FireMountainPrograms.com. It's FireMountainPrograms.com, Aaron at FireMountainPrograms.com. Our phone number is 303-443-3343. And if you call and set up an appointment, I will be happy to speak with you for a half hour, completely free of charge. And we can do a very good assessment on where to go next, what to do next, and how deep it is with your child, and how deep the problem goes. And I ask parents that when they do send me an email, tell me everything. And I call it the rant. Send me a 3-page rant email. Tell me everything. Because when we have that half-hour call, I don't want to use that time to have the history. I want to get the email with everything you need me to know on why the kid might be medicating and what's gone on. Because in that half-hour call, we're going to go deep and we're going to go fast and we're going to get to the root of what to do next rather than trying to figure out whether it's being done or not. And if you don't know whether your kid is using or not, this is where you want to hit the websites. There are so many. Use Google. It's the best community you've got. How to tell if your kid's using drugs. Google it. Watch what comes up. Go to the government-sponsored pages because they will give you everything. They have the resources, and they have the money to fill those resources.
All right, two questions. These are two critical questions. One, can you help parents outside the state of Colorado? Can you give them some information, advice? Can they pay you for a consultation?
Absolutely. We do online coaching for parents as well as teens. We do sober coaching as well as have kids as residents in our home. And we have kids who come from out of state. We have many kids here from out of state. We've had kids live in our homes from Canada. We have one from Florida, Detroit. So kids come from all over to stay at our home with us.
All right. Then the final question is, I'm guessing that it would be your goal, vision, and dream then to be able to duplicate your Fire Mountain Sober Living Home for Teens in other cities and other states.
Not only that, our very long-term goal is one sober home in every state, and that's nowhere near enough. Listen, I want to say this. We lost the drug war, and I said this to you at the beginning, Patrick. The minds left behind are wreaking havoc, and these kids are doing drugs. The pot that they smoke now, the pot that we smoked when we were kids, the pot that I used to smoke back in my day, had 3 to 6% THC in it. The pot that the kids are smoking nowadays have 30+% THC. It is not the same. And I say to parents, and I might I might get a few angry calls or letters back from this, but we don't know what it's like to be a teenager nowadays. We may remember what it was like to be a teenager when we were teens, but we are remembering from an adult perspective. We don't know what it's like. It has changed. The world has changed so significantly. And their access to every child has access to the Library of Alexandria. It's in their laps. It's on their desktops. And they can find anything. You need to pry. You need to get in there. You need to find out what websites your kids are visiting. You need to ask for help. You need to take care of yourself and take care of your relationships. Then and only then can you take care of your kid. It's so hard for parents to make that first step and go through the pockets of all the clothes in the closet and open those old keepsake boxes because we're terrified of what we're going to find. If we're not aware of what they're doing, then we can't help.
Right. If you inject any more passion into this, the phones, the computers will all catch fire. So I am so grateful for the amount of passion, enthusiasm, and zeal that you bring, obviously your entire soul, spirit, body, persona, to the work, great work you do. Thank you very much for the insights, the wisdom, the heart, the passion, and the soul that you've shared with us today. Aaron Huey, Fire Mountain, Sober Living Home for Teens, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Aaron Huey with Fire Mountain Sober Living Home for Teens. You can also email him at, one more time, Aaron.
Aaron@firemountainprograms.com.
Have an absolutely great day, and thank you once again.